from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Climate change is starting to have an impact on California agriculture. That's the thrust of a new series of reports and a television documentary from the Center for Investigative Reporting and KQED. Agriculture is big business in our state, a $31 billion enterprise to be exact. But as the state warms and water supplies decline, crops aren't as abundant, insects are more plentiful, and land that was once bountiful is becoming more barren. We'll explore the report's findings and hear excerpts from the documentary Heat and Harvest, ahead on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Triple digits in the inland valleys. Unseasonably hot. The warmest weekend of the year along the coast. That was the weather forecast on last night's evening news. And while one weekend does not climate change make, temperatures in California are expected to continue to rise over the next several decades. And according to a new documentary from the Center for Investigative Reporting and KQED, climate change is beginning to have a big impact on a crucial California industry, agriculture. From the grapes of the Napa Valley to the cherries of the Central Valley, the documentary examines the toll climate change is beginning to take on what California grows. The film is called Heat and Harvest, and it airs tonight at 7:30 on KQED9. And the subject of climate change and its impact on agriculture is our topic on this hour of Forum. Joining us first, Craig Miller, who is science editor at KQED and hosted and co-reported the documentary Heat and Harvest. Craig, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
And joining us as well is Mark Shapiro, correspondent for the Center for Investigative Reporting and California Watch, which co-produced the documentary with KQED. Mark, good morning as well.
Morning.
So let's start by saying what we know, Craig Miller, about temperature rising. You hear that it was so coincidental watching the news last night and hearing that forecast for the weekend, knowing that we were exploring this topic.
You're
going
to be hearing more forecasts like that. Yeah.
So what do we actually know about how much temperature is going to rise in the years and decades ahead?
Well, temperature's tricky. Just this year, the state came out with a new version of its official climate assessment. And from the research that various state agencies have looked over, they reckon that, let's say, by 2050, overall, average temperature in California will probably rise somewhere between 2.5 and 5 degrees by 2050, and that's compared to the year 2000. Now, 2-3 degrees doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're averaging, a lot of stuff gets buried. And the other thing they point out is that that would be 3 times the rate of warming that occurred last century. So how does that actually manifest itself? Well, for example, in Sacramento, the number of days in every year that you have 105 degrees or hotter might go in that same time frame from, say, 4 a year to 20 a year. And it's also – there's one other important factor here, and that is, as climatologist Bob Bornstein once told me, it's not like a big oven, you know, where you turn up the knob and everything warms up uniformly. Warming is going to happen differently depending on where you are. It's going to be more inland. It's going to be more during the summer. And it depends entirely, of course, on emissions. But the other quirks to it are springtime warming, particularly pronounced, says the report, and Sierra Nevada particularly pronounced. And, of course, this goes right to our frozen reservoir, the snowpack.
And so how do these kinds of changes, subtle changes, like perhaps that we get warmer sooner or that – how does that begin to affect, Mark Shapiro, agriculture in California?
Well, let's talk about it on a number of different levels. Number one, what you have is the cold season is getting shorter. The warmer season is getting longer. So in a number of ways, that prolongs the ripening process, which can actually lead to less well-formed fruits and vegetables, which is what we're seeing in parts of the Central Valley.
You would think in a way that seems almost counterintuitive, that a longer warm would be good. But what happens? What goes wrong in that process?
Well, number one, what goes wrong is plants, strangely enough, and I, of course, learned this in the process of reporting this piece, is that plants need it to get cold periodically to slow down their metabolisms to enable them all the kind of metabolic forces to flourish in a plant. So number one, They need a period of cold, and we have a segment on that in the documentary.
They call them chill hours.
Chill hours. They call them chill hours, basically. And a lot of fruit trees need chill hours, which some are not getting. And we talk about that in the documentary. The other way that the heat is affecting California agriculture is through the water that falls. So, for example, because the atmosphere is getting hotter, you have liquid. Let's call it liquid because liquid falls from the sky. We call it rain. People who like to go to the mountains and look out of the Sierras and ski call it snow. So basically the idea is that in December, January, we have a thing called snow, which is essentially water frozen. And traditionally, the California has created a water system which relies on the snow at the top of the mountains melting in April, May, June, when there's less water in the state, to kind of nourish the plants. Well, now what's happening because the atmosphere is warming is that the what used to fall as snow is falling as water, and it's all falling in that period, December, January.
So part of what's happening then, Craig Miller, is that the timetables are changing. It's not just that temperatures are inching up a degree or two, but it's throwing sort of this whole careful balance out of whack.
Yes, and that's a really important point. Scientists would say it's shifting the hydrograph of the state. Now, what that really means is that we're not necessarily looking at less precipitation overall, but what is happening is when that water becomes available to us, comes down from the mountains, that is shifting. We're going to get more and bigger doses earlier in the year. And so this nice, even distribution into the reservoirs and through the canals that agriculture depends on, that's changing rapidly.
So it's when as much as how much?
If not more.
Let's listen to an excerpt from the film. This is where, Mark, you go out to a cherry farm, and it's indicative of some of these subtle kinds of changes that are beginning to happen. So let's listen to an excerpt from the film Heat and Harvest.
Under the right conditions, cherry orchards like this one can produce nearly 3 tons of juicy cherries per acre. But scientists and growers have noticed that the odds of having a good crop seem to be changing.
That started off this way, but
Jeff Colombini's family has been farming cherries for 3 generations.
Biting into a fresh cherry, there's no other experience like that on Earth, in my opinion.
Now, if you look over here...
But Colombini is worried.
You've got, in the lower part of the tree, you've got leaves that are out already. You've got blooms that are done blooming.
Instead of coming in all at once, the blossoms are coming in stages, or not at all.
You got flowers that are just opening, and at the very top, leaves that are just starting to come out. I mean, it's just a very sporadic bloom.
So, Mark Shapiro, are cherries at the sort of top of the list of the kinds of crops that are being most affected in California?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is that cherries are really extremely sensitive to temperature, far more than other crops. They've become, many people are now calling them the canaries in the coal mine for climate change, and you can actually see and measure the effects on cherries very vividly of the shifting climate. And what this segment refers to here is this notion that traditionally cherries literally go into hibernation in the November to December period when it gets very cold and their metabolic structures shut down, which enables them to all come forth in April, May, when we all know those beautiful cherry harvests and see all the beautiful cherry harvests. Well, they all come out roughly the same time, and that's because they've been able to hibernate in December. Well, because it's getting warmer, you're having less time for enabling the cherries to hibernate. And one of the things that our farmer, Mr. Colombini, was talking about, this is a man who deeply knows his cherries. He used to be head of the Cherry Advisory Board here in the state of California, very knowledgeable about his crop, was saying that because he wasn't getting enough chill hours, there also appears to be a factor where there's not enough fog. There's less and less fog in that area. His farm's around Lodi. Less and less fog, which also serves to cool the cherries down, that the bloom is coming sporadically. We actually walked through his field, and you could actually see these various gradations in a tree. They look very pretty at the top. You see the top blooms, very pretty. If you drive by, it looks like a beautiful cherry tree. But then, as he points out, look at the middle of the tree. The middle of the tree, the cherries are stunted and they're half evolved. And the bottom third of the tree, there's no cherries coming out at all. That's what's called a sporadic bloom.
And this concept, Craig Miller, of the chilling hours, which sounds like a Stephen King novel or something, is part of this whole question that we need cold as much as anything else. That's part of what is being affected so much, not only with agriculture, but also, as we'll get to in a moment, with things like what's here that we don't want to have here necessarily during the winter, insects.
That's right. And it is pretty chilling if you're in the business of growing cherries, by the way, but the prospects. But in addition to these, what we've discussed now, these direct impacts of rising temperatures on crops, there are also indirect temperature impacts too, and one of them is bugs, the pests that some of which have been around for generations, in California, but they have sort of migrated in and out with the seasons. We're now finding are sticking around longer, sometimes not leaving at all. And they're having to cope with basically new pest problems, too.
So let's listen to an excerpt from the documentary that gets into this part of the problem. This is from a portion of the film where Craig goes to a part of California in the more towards the south near Bakersfield and discovers some unwelcome visitors.
In California's Cuyama Valley, an hour southwest of Bakersfield, an unwelcome visitor lurks in the potato fields.
Yep, that is a nymph.
That one is active.
Grower Brian Kirschenman and his crew are looking for tiny pests called potato tomato psyllids. The insects, both the young nymphs and the adults, are as small as the comma on a computer keyboard. But they wreak havoc on potatoes, tomatoes, peppers, 40 crops in all. In potatoes, they suck the plant dry. And what's worse, the pest can also transmit a disease that ruins potato chips. Despite the bad rap they get from nutritionists, potato chips are a $6 billion business.
An excerpt from the documentary Heat and Harvest, which airs tonight on KQED9 at 7:30, also Monday at 7:30. Right after that scene, you do a bit of a potato chip tasting. and the point of that is this subtle, again, impact. You wouldn't think about bugs having an effect on potato chips.
Yeah, it's very different with the tomatoes, for example. I mean, they can just outright ruin a tomato crop so it doesn't develop properly. With potatoes, it's much more insidious because basically, in feeding on the plant, it leaves behind a chemical that does something to the circulatory system of the potato, essentially, so that you don't know. If you're a grower, you don't know until you've planted, irrigated, treated, harvested, whether you've got this disease in the potato or not. It's not typically until it gets fried into a chip you see this kind of pinwheel pattern of what looks like burned areas on the chip. And it affects both the appearance and the flavor of the potato chip. It's not harmful to humans, but it affects the aesthetics, if you will, of the potato chip to a degree that the industry doesn't want them.
Let's bring into our conversation now John Trumbull, who is a professor of entomology at the University of California, Riverside, and who Craig interviews during the film. Professor Trumbull, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Give us some sense of this phenomenon now that's occurring in terms of insects that are here because of climate change. And first, can you tell us with some definity that it is because of climate change that these insects are here now at times when they have not been in the past?
Well, with potato psyllid, it's a little bit of a different story. We don't know specifically if it's because of climate change or there's been a change in the genetics of the organism. It appears to me that it's probably more climate change related. We've had a history of these things being introduced into California about every 30 years. They would last 6 months or a year, and then they would disappear. The last time they came in the year 1999 or 2000, they moved in and they're permanent. And this is a real problem for us. As Craig mentioned, they transmit a pathogen that causes the zebra chip effect on the potatoes.
And is the problem that they are now wintering here when they didn't used to? Is this sort of an unwelcome winter guest?
Absolutely. And our temperatures have increased about 2 to 3 degrees here in Southern California. And these insects have begun to overwinter in places where they never survived before for more than 6 months or a year. And we're finding them in San Diego County all the way up to Hollister on a an annual basis, and they've been here permanently. This year, they appeared in Idaho and Washington and as far north as Manitoba very early in the season, and the indication was that they were overwintering.
And what do we know, again, on this key question of what is the exact impact of climate change versus what might be just sort of random variation in our climate patterns? Are you able to say definitively as a scientist that, that climate change is having this specific effect, whether it is on some aspect of when insects are here or on other aspects of agriculture?
Yeah, I think we can make a pretty definitive case. Specifically, we can say that insects are developing faster. Insects are very closely related to temperature. As temperature goes up, insects develop more rapidly. We've already had an increase in temperature, so we can show this more rapid development. But there's also been a change in the USDA cold hardiness index. And if you look at that particular index for California from, say, 1992 to 2012, you see a very large change. There are many new subtropical and tropical types of plants that can be planted in California that could not be planted here before. And when homeowners move in and they plant these plants because they're available to nurseries, because the nurseries look at this cold hardiness map, they then create hosts for a whole variety of new insects that normally, had they been introduced, they would die off because it was too cool and there were no hosts that were suitable for them. Now the hosts are present in people's backyards and they can develop large populations and move out into agriculture.
John Trumbull, professor of entomology, joining us this hour from the University of California, Riverside. He is included in some of the interviews that are part of the documentary Heat and Harvest, which airs tonight on KQED9 at 7:30. It's indicative, Mark Shapiro, of these all these ripple effects. I would not have thought until John Trumbull said that about because now people are able to plant different things in their backyards, that those are that hosts. I mean, the ripple effects go on and on.
Yeah, I think the way to think of climate change is not as some sort of monumental single event where the temperature changes and everything's just going to get hotter suddenly. It's actually a cascade of events that one of which follows the other. So, for example, the fact that it gets that snow is not falling, is falling less in less quantities, that affects the flow of the water. The water comes down in December and January in quantities that the storage system is not set up to build, which means you're getting less water stored for the months when you need it. And it kind of which also then results, we talked later in the documentary about how that means that there's less water to drain the salt out of the land in the Central Valley. And I think in every case, when you look at climate change, you have to think of it as a sequence of events.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also very interesting to hear Dr. Trumbull talk about the notion of you asked for a definitiveness about climate change. The way to think about climate change is not that the one cause leads to another effect specifically. The atmosphere, of course, is constantly changing, and people are beginning to see climate change what's happening is the extremes are getting more extreme. Because, of course, there's always been changes in the atmosphere. And I think that's a very important part to kind of comprehend about climate change.
And Craig Miller, give us the kind of big picture look on what this means overall for California agriculture, the importance of agriculture to mm-hmm. the state in terms of its economic livelihood, and how this may be affecting that as we go forward.
Yeah, and as we pointed out, it already is. You talk about impacts. The grower that we interviewed down there with the potato fields lost one field, and he reckoned that one field loss was probably $250,000, about $250,000 loss to him. Now you multiply that, you know, by all the potato fields and all the tomato fields. Tomatoes, if you just take a swath from about Bakersfield to the northern Sacramento Valley, okay, so just the Central Valley grows a third of the nation's canning tomatoes. These are the things that go into tomato sauce, tomato paste, pizza sauce, and this kind of thing. A third of the nation's tomatoes are grown there. So we're not even talking about like the Imperial Valley and the other vast, you know, agricultural areas in California, just the Central Valley. And ultimately, of course, you know, the question we need to get to here is, you know, when is this and how is this going to hit your grocery bill? And what is your produce section going to look like 20 years from now? You know, is it going to even have the same products in
it? Yeah. And what do you think, John Trumbull? I mean, what do you imagine when you imagine that produce section that Craig is describing?
Well, I expect the prices will be higher. There's going to be a lot of pressure from insects that we're not accustomed to. For example, when the hillsides dry out, as was just discussed for the Sierras, that it rains in the winter, the weeds then develop. Well, they're going to develop more rapidly, and the insects will finish on those weeds much earlier. And the typical pattern is that they'll move down into commercial agriculture. Well, that's going to happen much faster than we've had in the past. So instead of seeing these populations in July or early August, you're going to find them in May and perhaps even earlier. And that's going to increase the costs of control applications that have to go on these crops in order to produce something that the U.S. consumer considers marketable.
Well, that's just where I wanted to go, which is this question then of how you deal with this. Does this mean that we'll start using more pesticides? Does this have an effect on the way in which crops are sprayed that might make consumers less than happy?
It's entirely possible. It's really up to the scientists and the growers to come up with strategies that are less pesticide intensive. If you look at what we've done in California on most vegetables, the ones that I'm familiar with are tomatoes and celery, for example, pesticide use has declined by over two-thirds. We've been able to make use of the beneficial insects, and we've created a much more sustainable approach to control. That is now at risk if we lose the beneficial insects because of the higher temperatures.
So what are you hearing, Craig Miller and Mark Shapiro, as you talked with farmers about how they're going to contend with this? Is it let's load up on the pesticides? Is it developing different kinds of crops? I mean, where do we find our way out for California's farmers?
You know, it's interesting. I just had to interject, you know, that there are some strange little upsides in this whole thing. We talked to Don Cameron, for example, who runs a huge 7,000-acre diversified growing operation called Terra Nova Ranch. Now, this is south of Fresno, and he said in the past there were, you know, spring frosts would occur with some regularity. Now they're not. And so they've actually been able to start their growing season sooner. The canneries can run longer, and it's actually been good for the economy. But I think everybody agrees that in the long run, these little advantages are going to be far outweighed by the disadvantages.
I mean, what's your cherry farmer going to do, Mark Shapiro? What are they thinking about in terms of strategies to contend with this?
Well, he actually doesn't quite know what he's going to do, because actually a cherry farmer cannot just simply move their cherry orchard. He's been watching this real serious disruptions to his farming operation. I think he's actually quite anxious. And I've even talked to some people, an Ag Extension agent who's based down in Stockton, who talks about having concerns about the continuing quality of California cherries and the potential future of California cherries. I mean, California, let me just give you an example with the economic consequences. And I do think it's an important thing, Craig mentioned, you mentioned, to understand the economic consequences of climate change today. So basically, people tend to think of climate change as some rolling kind of abstract concept that's happening up in the clouds that's slowly going to come down upon us. But all the things we're talking about here are get down to money. The actual costs of growing food are rising as a result of climate change.
Mark Shapiro and Craig Miller, let me hold you there because we have to get to a break. There are the hosts and reporters of tonight's documentary, Heat and Harvest, produced, by the way, by Gabriela Quiros of KQED and Serene Fang of the Center for Investigative Reporting. It airs tonight at 7:30 on KQED 9. We're going to take a short break. When we continue, we want to take your calls about this subject. What are your thoughts on the concerns that are pointed out in this film about the impact of climate change on agriculture? Your concerns as a potential consumer if more pesticides are used. 866-733-6786 is the number to join us. 866-733-6786. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the impact of climate change on agriculture in California. Our focus is on a film that airs tonight on KQED9 called Heat and Harvest. It airs tonight at 7:30. You can also read more about this topic in Mark Shapiro's reporting, which appears today in the San Francisco Chronicle. We'd welcome your participation in our conversation, too, at 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can post your thoughts or questions on our Facebook page or on our website. Joining us, too, John Trumbull, professor of entomology at the University of California, Riverside. And on the line with us as well now, Bharat Bisrabi, who is a farmer in Stanislaus County, where he grows almonds, olives, pomegranates, and citrus fruit. Bharat Bisrabi, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Tell us what your situation is right now, because there's a section of the film that deals with your work in the almond groves in particular and how threatened they are. Describe what your situation is right now, if you would, please.
Okay. Before I get into that, if I may, I was listening on the earlier section of the show. I wanted to make a little comment that supports what you were saying. We grow different varieties of citrus, and among those is a variety called Satsuma mandarins. And you see them in the market quite a bit. These Satsuma mandarins require cooler temperature in September to get the color.
Hmm.
And right now we're running into 100-degree temperatures, and they are not coloring. I mean, you're gonna expect them to see in the market, let's say, late October, and for us to harvest them, they need the cool temperatures to bring the color out.
So again, it's this question of you need that chilling effect in order for the crop to be what you want.
It's not chilling, really. It's a different effect of temperature, but you need lower temperatures in the fall so that the citrus fruit will have color. And if you don't have that temperature cooling off, it will delay the harvest. One of the reasons, for example, we are in northern part of the state. We're in Stanislaus County, closer to Patterson, and a little bit higher elevation. Our fruit is usually harvested 10 days before, let's say, Fresno area, because we get the delta breeze and we get those cool nights early fall, late September, and so our fruit matures a little earlier, brings up the color, and if the temperatures start rising, that is going to delay the harvest for us.
And tell us then the different kind of problem you're dealing with in terms of your almond groves.
So in the almond groves, and again, a lot of these problems have solutions, but the almond issue is the salinity and effect of salt on almonds. It is actually coming about as a result of shortage of water. We had the shortage of water a few years ago, and we still have some degree of shortage of water. So we're not able to get all the water that we need from the rivers and canals. We get our water from the federal project that comes from the Sierras, and we don't get enough of that water. And so we have to supplement our water needs with the water that we pull out of the ground from the wells, like 500 feet deep. The quality of these waters are not usually that good. And in our case, we have a lot of salt in these waters. And we irrigated a couple of orchards in 2009 with that water. And one of the orchards, it was affected so severely as a result of the toxicity from these salts that we tried for the last 3 years with all kinds of nutrition, pruning, and everything to try to bring this orchard back, and we just couldn't.
And so,
as I speak to you, the trees are laying on the ground, and they are being grinded this week. And so we took the whole orchard out, and we're going to start over again. Now, again, granted, the orchard was like 20-some years old, and they would have been pulled out maybe 5 years from now, but this salinity issue, the salt toxicity, caused us to take the orchard 5 years earlier, take it out 5 years earlier, and also the last 3 years, we lost probably several hundred pounds per acre of potential yield that we could have had had we not had the salt toxicity.
Bharat Bisrabi, a farmer in Stanislaus County, where it grows almonds, olives, pomegranates, and as you heard as well, citrus fruits, and the kind of impact that that is having on his particular farm. Stay with us if you would. There may be questions about your particular situation. We'd like you to be able to respond to them. Let's hear what some of our listeners are concerned about this morning. Phyllis joins us first from Dallas, Texas this morning. Phyllis, go ahead.
Yes. Thank you so much. Yes, I find this topic very just fascinating. I was wondering, you know, as a consumer, from a practical standpoint, at what point do you think farmers or growers will say, well, the best way to respond to the climate change is to change the crop? I know it sounds like a really easy answer, but from a practical standpoint,
right,
is that practical or...
Phyllis, thank you. Craig Miller, this is something you dig into in the film about the development of new kinds of crops to contend with the very problem that, that you're describing.
Yeah, and also just the idea of crop substitution maybe out of to a completely unrelated kind of crop. Like when we talked to Don Cameron, the grower down in Fresno County, he said that 30 years ago, for example, half of their entire ranch would have been in cotton. Cotton's a very water-intensive crop, so is alfalfa. Now they grow very little cotton, and they've switched to crops like tomatoes, which can be watered with drip irrigation, which is much more efficient. Doesn't necessarily save water overall, but it does increase yields, and there's a water saving to be had there. So there is some of this crop substitution going on already.
And what about the development of new drought-resistant kinds, so that you stay with the same crop, but it's one that can contend with climate change?
Well, that's going on, and I bet that John Trumbull can speak to that, because they're dealing on the genetic side also trying to with the pest problem.
John Trumbull, weigh in if you would, please.
Yeah, that's actually occurring at a fairly high level. There's a tremendous amount of breeding going on, and there are a few varieties that are out there that do offer significant drought resistance. There's one corn variety that's being planted in the Midwest that many growers are saying that may have saved them this year from the major drought that they had. It's much more difficult, though, to come up with drought-tolerant vegetables, and a lot of our crops here and the vegetables just don't have the varieties that we need.
Why is that?
I can't speak to that. I'm not a breeder myself, but I look mostly at insect resistance. So we're looking at the chemicals inside the plants that the plant naturally produces. But there are a number of people that are doing breeding studies, and I think they've come up with a new rice variety that can tolerate being under salty water for a longer period. So maybe they'll be able to use some of those waters that are heavily infested with salts. But I don't know that there's going to be a rapid development of any varieties that are going to be strongly drought tolerant. And that's only a partial fix unless you come up with a really magic variety. I would guess that it'll be years before we have anything that can tolerate drought at the level that it needs to be right now.
John Trumbull, professor of entomology at the University of California, Riverside. Mark Shapiro, you wanted to add?
Yeah, we just add that down. We actually went down to Modesto, down town very close to Modesto, the state's largest nursery, and which produces trees and plants for farmers across the state. They're very intensively involved with trying to devise crops to deal with these new circumstances, you know, basically high salt resistance, high drought resistant, not as water dependent, et cetera, et cetera. And so there's intensive efforts to deal with these consequences on a breeding level. Like Professor Trumbull said, the issue of water, there's only so much, you know, water you could take out of a plant's metabolism and enable to survive. There's a lot of challenges with that, a lot of challenges with doing the low chill.
And this, of course, raises all kinds of other interesting questions about whether you can engineer your way out of this. This raises the question of genetically modified crops, which, you know, the ripples go on and on. Let's hear what some of our other listeners want to talk about this morning. Phyllis, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Ruth in Sacramento. Ruth, go ahead, please.
Hi. You've been talking about the San Joaquin Valley. I haven't heard anything about vineyards and peaches and all peaches and nectarines, apricots. Can you talk a little bit about that? And then the second question is, those orchard farmers usually flood their fields. Is there a move now more toward drip irrigation, and are there issues related to drip irrigation, like ants getting into the tubes or whatever, that have to be considered as well?
Great questions, Ruth. Thank you. First, on the vineyard, you've done some reporting on that,
yeah,
Mark.
Yeah, and quickly on the drip irrigation, a lot more drip irrigation going on in the state right now than there was, for example, 5 or 10 years ago. I think a big, big step towards water conservation. And then in terms of the vineyards, yes, big question here with the vineyards. I mean, essentially you have because it's getting hotter in the areas, both in the coastal vineyards down near Santa Barbara area, as well as kind of Napa, Sonoma, There's an enormous effort being made by the wine companies there to adjust their fields to deal with the kind of onrush of sun. So actually you have people whose entire specialty now is like designing fields to increase the shade, to protect the grape more. What the big fear a year or two back, they had a huge sunburning of grapes, which is just devastating to wine growers. And some varieties that are more sun resistant are being developed in parts that hadn't happened before. So I think there's a shift in the varietals that's happening in Napa.
And John Trumbull, what about on the insect side? Our caller mentioned the drip irrigation flooding. Would that create other insect problems? Are there insect issues with whether it's vineyards or with peaches and plums and those sorts of fruits as well?
Not so much with the insect part. I'm more concerned about the drip irrigation versus the flooding. It's really a two-edged sword. It's really important. The drip irrigation is really important for saving water, as far as water conservation goes. But it's absolutely a disaster for ridding a field of salt. And so you have this problem that the more you use drip irrigation, the more salt buildup you have. And so that's a long-term concern that people are going to have to deal with. We do see some new ant species moving into California vineyards and orchards. As the temperature warms up, these things seem to be able to survive. The winters, usually it's not so much the heat during the summer. They can go underground and stay cool. But it's the cold temperatures that don't allow them to forage. And now, because it's warmer during the winter, they can forage and they can survive.
John Trumbull at UC Riverside. Craig Miller, pick up on that, if you would, please, in terms of this salt issue. It's part of what we heard from Bharat Bisabri earlier about this, again, double-edged question, because if you can't use as much water, then the soils become more salty.
Yeah, drip doesn't provide the same kind of flushing effect that other types of irrigation might. But again, on the flip side of that, for example, what it does do is it provides a much more steady hydration of the plant, which increases the yields substantially in the case of tomatoes, for example. It's like the difference between giving you a glass of water once a week or putting an IV in your arm and giving you, you know, and literally giving you the steady flow that keeps you hydrated and literally cools down the fruit when they have these blistering heat waves in the Central Valley. So, it's a Hobson's choice.
Eric in Palmdale, California has our next question. Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, good morning. I'm a small organic grower down in the high desert in Palmdale, and we've seen this season a movement of this just devastating insect called a Bagrata beetle that will totally destroy cabbage, cold crops like radishes, kale, collard greens. Being organic, we can't do anything about it except hope that they move out, and We've never had an insect issue. We grow about 100 different varieties of 40 different vegetables on this small farm, and it's very diversified, and we have lots of beneficials. But we can see this insect is probably going to put us out of business on about wow. 10 very popular greens. And I think it's, you know, I know this thing came in from northern Africa, but it's really scary.
And what is the name of it again, please, Eric?
I believe it's called a Bagrata beetle. It's a small stink bug, that black little bug that ruins your the leaves on these yeah. greens, and they can't establish.
And John Trumbull, can you respond? Tell us something more about that bug and whether it's connected to the climate change issue we've been discussing.
The correct name is the Bagrata bug, and it is a very serious problem. It did move in from North Africa and into the east coast of the U.S., where it's caused many millions of dollars in damage. It can be controlled with pesticides. It's the organic operations that are really the biggest problem. And what it's doing in California is that it's requiring growers to put on additional pesticides that they normally wouldn't put on in order to try and bring these things under control. It's an absolute disaster for the organic guys, and I really feel for them.
And Eric, if you're still with us, would this persuade you to go away from your organic practices and treat it?
No, we'll just have to move. We're seriously against pesticide use, and we think that's a whole issue that is going to get more important to Californians and people in the United States as we get into more of these GMO-type crops, which we aren't allowed to use in the organic systems. Those are going to increase some of these pesticide usages, particularly herbicides. But, you know, I think people are getting more concerned with the chemical load that's getting in the food supply. And that's, you know, that's a tough question because people got to eat. We got more people to feed. And those chemicals play a role in the food supply. You know, my goal is to eliminate as much of that kind of stuff as possible by being organic. But these new superbugs that are coming along,
yeah,
are quite frightening. So I don't know. We'll grow more tomatoes. We don't have problems with tomatoes. We can help those out like crazy.
All right, Eric. Thank you. All Thanks right. for adding your perspective on this. Mark emails in with a similar concern. He writes, it's a common but mistaken perception that the only response for agriculture against climate change is more pesticides or different crop varieties. In short, doubling down on the currently dominant system of conventional agriculture. A comparison of organic and conventional methods over a 30-year period conducted by the Rodale Institute in Pennsylvania found that under the hot and dry growing conditions that climate change will increasingly unleash organic agriculture, which actually enjoys higher yields. Can you give us any perspective on that, John Trumbull? I mean, what's the way out for organic farmers?
Well, personally, I think that the best bet is to get either locations where the insects don't occur or to use varieties that are much more tolerant or less damaged by these insects. We're going to see a lot of new insects move into our area. I don't know that organic agriculture is going to be able to expand rapidly, and that's going to be a real concern for us in the future.
Linda in Napa joins us next. Linda, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a comment and a question. I've had the good fortune to work in issues related to both sustainable agriculture and climate change, and so my comment is this, that agriculture is both a contributor to climate change and offers potential solutions to some of the climate change gases that are released. So we all know that the ag chemical industry and the chemicals that are used are contributing to the problem of climate change itself, and tillage practices and other practices as well are contributing to the problem. But fortunately, by making good, sustainable decisions in farming practices, some of those releases of greenhouse gases can be reduced. Moreover, soil sequesters carbon, and so there are ways to enhance that soil sequestration of carbon. So that's my comment, and my question really relates to the fact that we're addressing and discussing adaptation strategies to climate change. But with all of the resources and the economics at stake that you've been discussing, these huge industries, what about diverting a lot of that towards some of the policy making that's going on? If agricultural interests as a bloc went to both parties and said, we need to address climate change, we need to fundamentally put our money into resolving and solving this problem rather than us all trying to scramble to try to find some sort of adaptation solutions, at least a portion of that resource could really make a difference.
Linda, thanks. Thanks for the call. I'm curious about this, Craig Miller and Mark Shapiro, about whether farmers are up in arms that you talk to, ready to charge on Capitol Hill, as Linda suggests they ought.
Well, you're talking about the mitigation side of the equation, though, which or Linda was, you know, which is reducing the carbon footprint of farms. There is a bill might have been signed into law by now by the governor, or maybe still sitting on his desk, that actually will create programs for some of the money that the state's going to be getting from the cap and trade program that's coming up, the carbon fees they'll be charging businesses to recycle that money, you know, into programs on farms that would allow them to reduce their carbon footprint. And there's various strategies for that.
And there is a lot of actual interesting research being done on how farms can actually reduce, both on the one hand, reduce their carbon footprint and also reduce the dramatic impacts on the land from climate change. For example, experiments in how you would sequester more carbon in soil by adding compost. some very interesting explorations in terms of enriching soil to make it conserve water more thoroughly than it does currently. So there are a lot of interesting experiments, some of which come out of the, you could say, mainstream agricultural community, some come out of the organic community. But I think a lot of forward-thinking agronomists are basically moving along these lines.
So a comment from Alan, who writes in, there's been almost no high marine layer in Oakland this year. I moved here in the 60s, where there was always a thick, chilling marine layer, fog covering the area for days at a time. I'm enjoying the lovely weather, but I fear it portends very ill effects. If you're still with us, Bharat Bisabri, this is part of what you were discussing as well, right? That you aren't getting some of that chilling, cooling fog, and that's part of what's affected your citrus crop?
Absolutely. I mean, the fog doesn't, this time of the year, the fog doesn't get in this far, but the deeper marine layer means the cooler nights for us. And then we need those close to 50 degree temperatures at night for this citrus fruit to bring color. And in the absence of that, it's going to be delayed. And then you get into a situation of like November, and then the rainy season starts, and you cannot harvest citrus when it's raining. You cannot harvest citrus when the fruit is wet. And so we're going to be forced against the time to harvest all this crop in a short window, and then the consumer in the meantime is not going to get their fruit in a timely basis.
Bharat Bisabri, citrus as well as an almond grower in Stanislaus County. We haven't talked yet, and we should, about one other aspect of this that relates some to some of the issues that Bharat Bisabri is dealing with in terms of salt, and that's that because of rising oceans, there's more salt sort of advancing, which means you need to have pushback, right, from water flowing down through the delta, which in turn causes other problems. Give us some sense of that.
Yeah, it was incredible. I actually learned this in the process of reporting this. Well, I learned a lot, certainly, about farming in the process of reporting this. And it turns out, of course, that one of the significant effects of climate change is the rising sea level. And the San Francisco Bay is anticipated to rise as much as 18 inches by 2050. And so the state, because the water that goes to the Central Valley, which is what we're talking about here, comes through the Sacramento Delta, comes out of the mountains, flows into the Sacramento Delta, is then pumped down to the Central Valley from the Delta. Well, the Pacific Ocean is lapping into the Delta. And the more the Pacific Ocean rises, the more salt going into the Delta. So the state of California takes huge amounts of this precious fresh water to push back the ocean. And there's actually a line in the middle of the Sacramento River where the fresh water meets the salt water in this underwater battle to hold back the salt.
And does that mean then that we're using fresh water as a kind of line of defense against rising oceans that could be used otherwise for other agricultural purposes?
Yes, yes. And the Department of Water Resources says that explicitly. They go, the water we use to hold back the sea is water that's not used for agriculture.
Eric joins us next in our conversation this morning. Eric, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I don't know about peaches, but a lot of the crops, many of the crops you're talking about come from other parts of the world originally, and there are still existent, although fast disappearing and becoming extinct, many, many species of these or varieties of these plants, like in Peru for potatoes and Mexico for corn. Apples come from Kazakhstan, and I know that Cornell does a lot of work on apples. But is anybody trying to have a systemized program of finding additional and preserving these natural varieties in the countries where they come from before they become extinct?
Eric, thanks for the call. Mark Shapiro?
I can answer that quickly. There is an incredible vault. I've wanted to visit it, actually, in Norway, in the hills of, in the, way up in the freezing hills of Norway, mountains of Norway, where they are making an effort to preserve
the seed vault.
Yeah, the seed vault in Norway to preserve these seeds that are rapidly disappearing across the earth, some of them because of climate change.
And John Trumbull, can you weigh in on sort of the mixed effect, I guess, of developing or bringing in new varieties? You talked before about people planting new things in their yards because now climate will allow that. Is this something we have to be wary of, though, in terms of how we adjust and bring in new things because that will in turn have an additional ripple effect?
Oh, absolutely. One of the big problems they discovered in Florida was the movement of citrus seedlings from the southern part where the nurseries were up to the northern part of the state, and they discovered that during that movement they moved the Asian citrus psyllid, which causes citrus greening. And so I would anticipate that movement between countries that's not regulated carefully could result in the introduction of many new insect pests and diseases as well. We've seen that already in California. We get about 6 new major pests per year, and those are the ones we find. There's probably a great many that occur in natural systems that we miss for a long period of time.
Sounds like a fascinating but worrisome time to be an entomologist. Just a last quick word from you, John Trumbull, on what you're most worried about.
Money?
No, my biggest concern would be the introduction of new species. I think that some of the new invasive species that could potentially come into California have the potential to be extremely destructive, like the bagrata bug that we mentioned earlier,
yeah,
and like the potato psyllid that's come in that's damaged to the potato crops.
And
my reference there, Dave, by the way, was I better explain that, was to John's concern that he voiced to me about the dwindling funding for research to try to find some of these solutions.
And from both of you, what ought consumers, farmers, all of us keep an eye on? The sort of, you mentioned the canary in the coal mine before, but what do we need to be most concerned about as we go forward? Mark Shapiro and then Craig.
I think we need to quickly put very fast the California situation in a global perspective, because basically California is a microcosm for the challenges facing the food system globally. And if you look all across the world, from Europe to Asia to Africa, you have similar kind of stresses being put on the agricultural system. So as we lay out these details in California, extrapolate to other parts of the world to understand what this means.
A lot of politics involved, as you know, in the water situation, Dave, but there is no scenario going forward that would produce more farm water, really, in the future. So this is the main pressure point, I think.
I want to thank all of you for your participation this morning. Again, the film is called Heat and Harvest. It's reported by Craig Miller and Mark Shapiro. It's produced by KQED and the Center for Investigative Reporting. Producers Gabriela Quiros of KQED and Serene Fang of CIR. Also want to thank John Trumbull, who appears in the film this evening, as does Bharat Basrabi. Thanks for your participation in both the film and in our program this morning. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Howard Gelman is our engineer this morning. Raul Ramirez is our executive producer. Again, Heat and Harvest tonight at 7:30 on KQED9. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.